For me, as an artist on the third decade, let's say, of the 21st century, I try to understand what are the means of production that are available for me today and also reflect the world that I live in. If it's using AI technology, if it's like globalized means of production, for me, that's all part of the same concept.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is artist Amir Fatal. I came across Amir's work through Instagram, and Amir is creating sculpture and painting based on artificial intelligence. But let's hear directly from himself in the podcast. Welcome, Amir Fatal.
Thank you very much for having me.
Amir, how did you get into art or understood that making art can be a profession?
I started quite early. Already for high school, I went to an art high school in Tel Aviv. And I studied for 4 years art quite in depth, including art history, painting. That actually got me a job in the army to be a graphic designer. So I actually learned Photoshop and multimedia already in the mid-90s. So pretty much since I'm 14, I've been focused on being a professional artist.
And this idea of making art as a profession, did that exist in your surrounding or family?
No, not at all. I was the first one. I'm first generation Israeli. So both my parents immigrated from Baghdad to Israel in the 1950s. And at that time, there was no possibility for this type of careers. Mm-hmm. So it was really, I would say, my curiosity and passion that got me into it.
Mm-hmm. And they understood what you were doing?
Yes. I mean, of course, my dad would have rather that I would be an architect and not an artist. He thought that, you know, I should have like a stable career, but they were fully supportive.
What was he doing?
My dad worked for the electricity company as a manager.
Mm-hmm. And your mother?
A special education.
Okay. So you didn't go to an art school. When do you think you found your language in what you were doing?
Well, no, I went to Utica eventually. So when I was 21, I left Israel. I first moved to New York. I lived there for a few years, tried to kind of enroll myself into an art university, but it was way too expensive. And I think by then I visited Berlin a few times and I just felt really drawn to Germany. I also really loved German art as a teenager, like Anselm Kiefer and Boys, and yeah, I felt kind of connected. And yeah, eventually in 2003, I enrolled to UdK, studied with Katharina Sivading and Hito Stel, and graduated in 2009.
Ah, okay. So you came here in the late 90s?
2001.
Oh, yeah, that's when I came here too. Yeah. Yeah, Berlin was very active, and there was so much space, and
yeah,
it was much easier to somehow create art because expenses were much lower, no?
Yeah, I mean, there are also a lot of opportunities to do big events and stuff like that. And already when I was at university, I started curating and organizing big events. At the time, I was working for Jörg Jüding at Heidestrasse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the whole area behind Hamburger Bahnhof was developed. And I remember, because there were like 20 galleries there, they thought, okay, what can we do to promote that area? And then I found out there was this club called Tape Club, and they had like this huge warehouse next to it. And that when I started doing these exhibitions that we called it Tape Modern.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed 6 exhibitions a year every time with like 25 artists in one big dark hall. So I was actually very interested in how to show art at night, you know, that everything is kind of painted black and you have like a spotlight and creating that atmosphere that is different than seeing art during the day.
You think it helps you that you know also how the art world or art market works from two sides, from
yes,
from like the student side from UdK, but also from the inside the gallery and organizing non-profit exhibitions?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I have a lot of respect for what galleries are doing. I know, I saw how hard it is, you know, it's not taken for granted. But I think for myself also, I like to work with people. I always found it very hard to be alone in the studio the whole day. And I love to have the opportunity to work with my friends, to show their art together. It's like a social extension for me, for my practice.
Katharina Sieverding is a conceptual photographer, and Hito Steil is also, I would say, conceptual media artist. So you work with artificial intelligence, but also with a lot of data. Yeah. When did this language facilitate in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a student, I was doing mostly photography and video. I think at some point, Instagram kind of killed my passion for photography, and I found it harder and harder to make photos as photos. There was too much of it, you know, like also the moment Instagram came, the saturation of being exposed to that type of medium, I guess I wanted something else.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point I also started, I would say, a second career. I was a creative and marketing director for a tech company in Berlin called BigRap, and they make the largest 3D printer in the world. Mm-hmm. And my job was to show the applications of what you can make with a large-scale 3D printer or industrial one. And yeah, and I guess this is the first time that I really got more interested in how to manipulate data, but also the relationship between the digital and the physical. Because people think that 3D printing, it's like magic, that by a press of a button, you get an object. But of course, everything can exist in the digital world, but the physical world is very different. It has limitations of gravity, it has limitation of heat, temperature, and stuff like this. And I was quite curious on how those two elements work together. That was also my first introduction to blockchain, because we were looking at blockchain technology for 3D printing in order to control the file and how it's being manufactured. So this kind of interest in technology and innovation, and especially how it can affect the physical world, let's call it that, was something that I was very much interested in. And eventually, when AI came, it kind of merged into, I would say, much more coherent practice that made sense for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you say with Instagram, even probably a little bit before, when the iPhone started to hit everybody. And like everybody became a photographer, which is interesting when we think of Walter Benjamin's thoughts on the aura of photography 100 years ago. Somehow this problem of reproducible images were on steroids somehow, because it, not only the photo itself got reproducible, but also the action of taking a photo became sort of a mess.
Yeah, and I think also the relationship of the action of photography and the presentation of the self, because Instagram has a lot to do with, if you look at a lot of the profiles, it's I've been there, you know, it's like it's a question of taste, where you want to kind of connect yourself into the things that you do. I went to this concert because I love this musician and I want people to know that this is part of my taste. I go on vacation here. I go to this exhibitions. I upload images of that. So there is a lot of affirmation, I think, in the way that people are using photography on social media.
Yeah, that point, I think, will get more important also when we get into your painting practice, because also it's somehow about a imaginated representation of life or lifestyle or something like this. But before we get there, it's interesting what you say about getting through a pay job so early into this new products, because when we look at art history, like Dara Birnbaum or other early media artists started to work with film and video when these products became household mass products, which I think is interesting. So that often artists pick up or adopt consumer products as soon as they are there and then incorporate them into their practice. And so you were, by coincidence, I guess because you needed a pay job, getting early into that 3D printing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I never really applied for a job. I always kind of thought, okay, what do I want to do next? And kind of made that position for myself. If it was going and pitching to do the exhibitions. At some point, I also directed the artist studio at the Funk House, and I came to the guy and told him what I can do. And yeah, I just felt that I was really intrigued by 3D printing, and I kind of looked what are the jobs that were available. At the time, Big Rep was just starting. I think I was like the 15th employee, and I just came to the CEO and I told him, okay, I think I can do this for you. And that's how it started.
But the printer back then, how big was it?
1 cubic meter.
Okay, wow. Yeah. And maybe you can explain a little bit, because as you say, I think a lot of people think it's just like a button and then it comes out, because it's a very, very long, tiring process and a lot of prints go wrong because it's so sensitive to like a shakeup. Like if you have the printer on a table and only...
I mean, a move of a millimeter would
destroy the whole image.
It has to be very stable.
But it's interesting because also with your paintings, so in your practice... It seems you like to have that process handed over, like that there's an intermediate between the image you want to realize, if it's three-dimensional or two-dimensional, in creating the image and then also in executing the image. You seem to like to have sort of outsourced steps in it. I guess because of the 3D printer, you started with sculptures of busts, right? Human busts. And how did you get to the sort of master file of the three-dimensional image, which then would be produced? How did you get to that?
Yeah, it was a very long process. Yeah. So the work is called Love Child. It started when I saw a TED talk of a professor from Penn University talking about DNA imaging. And the fact that if you just give them a text file of your DNA, they can actually visualize your face. They know how to connect certain genes in the way they create your physical appearance.
So the DNA is enough to sort of recreate
your visual face. Yeah.
Your face,
yeah.
Which is
like
probably not so influenced by eating or health or...
Yeah, no.
Not the body shape, but the face.
Yeah, it's being developed for forensic science. Mm-hmm. So if they find evidence, they can actually already understand more or less how the person looks like, their race, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I was quite curious about this kind of data turning into visualization. And I asked them what happened if I would give him my DNA and a DNA scan of 6 of my friends, if it would be possible actually to mix my DNA with one friend and do like 6 offsprings.
So like a morph.
Yeah, like a morph. Like as if I would have had a child with that friend, how would that person look like? But they can only do the face. They cannot do the head, the ears. At least that was how it was back then. So then I used 3D scan of my own body. And then we started kind of playing with it, like adding the faces to it, having a little bit of like a ripple effect over the surface to kind of make each and every one of them unique. So they have like this kind of interesting futuristic look. But what I love about it, that it's really based on actual data of my DNA and my friends.
Because it's surprising with the DNA, like your DNA to my DNA is only different by less than 2%. Mm-hmm. But that still makes a huge difference, but like we are all equal, but a mini difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just the accuracy of the fact that they know the shape of the eyebrow, the shape of the nose, you know, things that you would not expect DNA to reveal, but somehow with their technology, they make it possible.
So, but then you have that file, which gets translated again in a 3D print, which also have, I guess, naturally, like everything physical, unpreciseness, no?
Well, it depends. I mean, I already got from them like a 3D file of the face, and then I use that as they gave it to me. I didn't change that, and I added the 3D scan and whatever we changed. But to print that was actually not so complicated. I mean, a bust, in a way, is not a very complicated thing to print. The problem is usually if you have over 45% degrees, so the material doesn't have anything to sit on, and then it falls. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. But a bust is not a very complex form.
And these are also the busts which are in our exhibition now.
Yeah, we're going to show, I think, 2 busts of the DNA and one that is just my scan that almost has like a erosion effect on it.
Mm-hmm. And the material is a material which came out of the printer.
Yeah, it's thermoplastics. It's called PLA. And after that, it's post-processed and lacked.
The post-process is that it gets...
That smooth surface. Smooth, yeah. So you don't see those lines that are very familiar with FDM process.
Yeah, because of the printing layers build up on each other. That's why it has these lines. But I think it's interesting. So there is a hand touch to it.
Yes,
because it
needs,
to be smooth. So it's like compromised data somehow. Aestheticized data.
I wouldn't say. I think maybe it's a compromise technique because you can still not automate post-processing. It's a very complex thing to do. So it has to be done by hand. But this is really more just about the surface. It's not about the form itself.
Sure, but you touch it with the hand,
yes.
Which I think is interesting because moving over to the images you create with AI, which maybe are less purely data-based, is so you create portraits of humans, male, female couples, male couples, in an environment of sort of a dreamy interior shots where they somehow stand or sit in an, I think, kind of weirdly aestheticized.
It's like an idealized art world.
Yeah, like an idealized art world, but also an idealized on a somehow commercial, or it creates an image which is reproduced by Architecture Digest and going back to what you said about Instagram, because everybody presents a life in Instagram. They want others to believe that they live this life or they would like to live this life. And it shows, also somehow a hyper-capitalist.
Yes.
So it's interesting because by reproducing these images, we all seem to aim for living in such an environment. I think of the Peloton advertising or things like this. And I wonder, where do you think this is coming from?
I think it reflects the data in the engine. I think a lot of it comes from Instagram. A lot of that comes from lifestyle magazines, from fashion magazines.
But I mean, before, it's like modernist architecture. And I wonder, where is this idealization coming from of these glass and steel and lofts? Where do you think that began?
I think there's the work in a way is exploring what is taste according to data. And when I think about the art world, there's certain elements in it, especially when it comes to 1950s architecture, this kind of classic modern design that is, even after 70 years, very much sought after and very much considered to be good taste. And I'm kind of trying to understand, how do you take all those the style elements and synthesize them? Because in the way AI is very good in synthesizing different elements or making hybrids. So I'm taking all these different elements that are considered to be in good taste and see how I can create something with it.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you look at these people, which are also artificially generated, they are all look, I would say, like successful. They're like middle age, in their 40s or late 30s. They fit certain, they have, I would say, what would be called attractive. You know, they don't visually have any issue. You know, they don't wear glasses, or if, then maybe they're more like a style choice. But at the same time, they're quite lonely. But probably it's a little bit like in the other couple of sessions before, Stefan Balkenhol spoke about his sculptures, that he tries to create the work with the faces he's creating, that they don't really have an expression. And that the spectator projects their own inner emotions on their face.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the case here too.
Yeah, because there's a certain type of default in the engine of when you do something and it gives you like a, almost like a middle ground result. So when you design with it and you add all these different prompts, if you start with a very short one with no other, external elements to change the style, you would always get some kind of like a very default aesthetics that it's kind of like the average of what it finds as beautiful. And it always a little bit borderline illustrative kitsch. So I would say this is almost like the default that I found in the engine itself if you keep the prompt very simple. Now, the moment you start, you know, tweaking it and trying to add layers into it, then you start to get more and more, I would say, character into it. But this is, for me, this kind of dance, or this collaborative dance between me and the AI, this is really where I find my interest and passion now, because I really try to understand how it works. Mm-hmm. Or how it thinks, if you want to call it that way. And that's take a lot of trial and error. But eventually you kind of understand, because what's interesting about AI compared to other creative works, that it's not really an additive process. It's not like you would start with an empty canvas and slowly build up, or when you work on a program that has many, many layers, so then you can actually just go back once. Here you always start from 100. And once you have this finished product, let's say you want to change something into it, then you really need to understand what happens if you do certain things and how it reacts. And
because usually it starts from zero again to 100.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ah, yeah. So it's like similar to ChatGPT or other tools. You have to, like, you start always from scratch, and then you have to understand, what do I add in my first prompt to create a different reaction, and then work on this again and realize, okay, then it went too far in this way.
Exactly.
And so on. So you said it's like a rabbit hole. So you spend hours and hours each image.
I think about 7 hours a day now.
Yeah.
Since almost 2 years. I mean, I work on Midjourney. I started working on it 6 months before ChatGPT was even released. So my first experience in prompting actually came from a visual aspect and not a textural one. And I find it very fascinating as an artist to really go back and your tool is actually text and not, a paintbrush. It's a mm-hmm. very, very different process.
But you also use images. You upload images too.
As well, yeah. I mean,
like moods.
Yeah, I mean, now that I've been working on it for almost 2 years, of course, also my technique has changed. Mm-hmm. Also different versions are coming up every few months. What I do a lot, it's what I call reverse engineering, which is you actually upload an image and you ask the AI to give you the prompt. Mm-hmm. And this is where you really learn a lot, because then you understand the terminology of how the AI see certain elements and what are the words that he's using for it. And that's very helpful. And once I do that, I almost work like in a collage. I can actually reverse engineer a few images and then take certain sentences and words and kind of build them again into a new image. And the words are usually like the structure mm-hmm. Of the building, you say. And then the style can be changed by adding images that kind of, they don't really change the theme, but they change the style. Mm-hmm. So, and I like to take different references for different things, because at the end of the day, it's the most, I think, most powerful creative tool that humankind have created so far. And what's interesting about it, that it's completely based on the entire humankind creativity. It's all there. Mm-hmm. You know, you just need to know how to synthesize it in the right way. And for that, you can use both text and images.
Because what's interesting, you create these environments of these human beings in their sort of posh, idealized, modernist architecture environments, and they have lots of art on the wall and sculptures. And it's interesting that they remind the spectator of something they have seen. So it also appears a little cynical, mm-hmm. because, I mean, it looks like art, and it reminds you of, not really definable, but here's a little pop art, there you see some, I don't know, Californian gay vibe.
It always feels very familiar.
Yes. Yeah. And like, is it a comment on today's art or the art world as well?
I mean, it's not a cynical comment, maybe it's more like a cheeky comment. I mean, there's two things that you brought up. I mean, the first one, I do love putting artworks in the images, in the theme, because then it means that the AI is the artist of this artwork. There's a different thing between just creating an image and creating an image that within the image there is artwork, like an artwork within an artwork. So that meant that the AI created that artwork, that painting, that sculpture. And I found it fascinating to see how, what it comes up with, you know, what kind of paintings it creates on its own. Later on, I started also doing multiple artworks on one wall. So there's always some elements of curation in it, of how different images that it creates relate to each other.
Maybe here it's important to mention that you are not changing it, right? No. You're taking the result. So you work on the result until you satisfy it, but you're not sort of interfering with it and say, okay, I take this picture out and put another one in.
No, I'm so not Photoshopping it. It's very important for me. Some people, what they see, it's what the AI created.
After your guidance.
Yeah, sometimes I change a little bit the details, enhanced details on the faces of the figures, but not more than that.
But you create artworks with AI, but you don't create single artworks with AI. You create an environment or like a interior and a portrait of a human, including artworks on the wall created by AI.
Yes, create a situation where the AI can be the artist within the artwork.
Which you create, but you never wanted to create only sort of because there are abstract works in it or portraits, but you never created single artworks, not in an invented environment.
Yeah. In the beginning, I kind of did, but you know, but it was also kind of like I had like my first series was kind of like this reclining figure on a bench next to a pool, and then there was always be in the background something that it's a little bit like a mural, something like that. So it was kind of like half painting, half part of the architecture. So that's how it actually started. And then
very interesting series, because you on the first side you think it's a person because it has like the silhouette of a person, but then you realize it's sort of a distorted person with like an abstraction, almost like a baconish figure or something like this.
Yeah, it's like the figure and the chair or the sofa kind of merged together
to with one, The pictures created include these human beings. Do you project a story on them, like? Are they clear characters for you?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, you know, we talked about very much about the entire framework, maybe of the conceptual framework of how I work. But once I start designing, I actually design from a very emotional and intuitive place. I'm very much interested if I'm connecting to the character, to the relation of the character within its environment. At that point, it's really very much intuitive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then with the result, you have that painted. It's oil on canvas?
Yes.
Yeah. Why that? Why not a print, like a photographic print?
Yes. You know, when I started working on it, I have to say I didn't think that I would make art from it. When I started working with Midjourney, I was really just very passionate about the technology. And the more I worked with it, only then I started understanding why I'm interested in it. So the fact that it's artwork became months and months and months later. I mean, when I started doing it, I did it for myself. And what I realized at the point that it has an amazing mental effect on me. It makes me happy. It makes me relaxed. It's really like the opposite of doom scrolling. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you feel like you're creating something. It has a similar interface as far as this kind of gamify, clicking on buttons, or like you do likes and selecting and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it actually had a very positive effect on me. And then later on, the more I worked with it, then I kind of understood what is interesting in it for me as an artist.
Yeah, what I think is interesting is that when I look at these pictures, because also the sunlight which appears, you know, going through the room, going over the paintings, over the face of the portrait, almost like a holiday or like an escapism, you know, like. But I wonder what that is that triggers us, probably again with beauty and face, which has a genetic reproductive motivation or something like this. And I find that interesting thinking about modernist architecture because it seems to push the buttons what we desire.
I think the AI has a very good understanding of what human find pleasing. And when I look at those images, this is what I'm fascinated about. It's how it's able to create this kind of really interesting balance of elements, colors that the human eye finds very attractive.
But at the same time, you wonder, okay, they look like these successful metrosexual, you know, ideal few 2% who made it. Because these apartments or houses, you sometimes wonder, are they made for themselves because they feel human and comfortable there? Or is it also because that's what you do and to show off and so on? I mean, back to the Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, in some way, I'm kind of, when I was doing that, I was thinking, okay, all this really expensive artworks, where do they go, right? Once they leave the gallery or the trade show, who are the people who can afford, you know, $100,000 paintings? And once those paintings are going into the collector's house, how do they show the art, right? So it, in a way, it's kind of trying to imagine the next step of what's happening to art once it leaves the gallery, and how do people relate to it, who buy it, and what is, you know, good taste in their mind. So it's kind of creating this fantasy in a way.
And did you ever think about realizing these paintings yourself?
Well, first of all, I mean, I learned painting, but I don't think that I'm such a good painter that I can do it to the level that they do it. And I also wanted to have a little bit of distance from it, because for me, you know, this it's about balancing two technologies, you know, because you have the AI as the new technology, and this is where I call it also a collaborative work between me and the AI, and then I finish the image. Once the image is finished, it's finished. And then it's just a question of translating it into the canvas, and I didn't want to have it done by a machine. Because for me, painting, it's also a technology. It's a technology that served humankind for thousands of years, until photography came along about, you know, 170 years ago. And copying within painting, it's also a technology, a know-how, a technique. And this translation of somebody who is not necessarily emotionally connected to the image like I did, who created it, I love the fact that then it's being painted in the most traditional way in order to turn that into a painting.
Sure, and all the traditional painters, they had workshops with tons of painters.
Correct.
Executing under their realm. I mean, it's also, again, I think a result of modernism, that sort of the idea is that the painter is a unique artist, like Da Vinci and so on. He had like a whole team.
I think when we go into museums today, we see the painting. We don't really realize what was the mean of production of a painting from the 1400 or
especially with old
longer.
Masters. Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So for me as an artist on the third decade, let's say, of the 21st century, I try to understand what are the means of production that are available for me today and also reflect the world that I live in. So if it's using AI technology, if it's like globalized means of production, for me that's all part of the same concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is interesting because it merges like plays a lot with capitalism and production and art history in a wider span. And how did you source the painting studio which realizes the paintings for you?
Well, it took some time. It was a lot of like online search and then doing tests with different agencies to see what's the quality and if it translates well my designs. But in a way, maybe going back, what I'm really looking for in those aesthetics, it's actually to understand what is contemporary. Mm-hmm. And for me, those images of this kind of perfection, you know, they do seem very contemporary of right now. I think if people would look at those portraits 100 years from now, they would really have some type of aesthetic understanding of our time today. And if we think about, you know, the word zeitgeist, I think the AI itself is a tool of the zeitgeist, because it always kind of brings all the elements who are up to date and synthesize it into a coherent image. But for me, that access to this vast visual knowledge that our brain cannot compute, but an AI program can, this is what really interests me.
Interesting. Yeah, because when we look at images now from the early 2000s, I mean, it, in our memory, things didn't change so much.
Yeah.
But when we see the style and so on, it's completely different. But so you try to create images of today, because you could also tell the AI...
Yeah, of course, to make something in the style in the 80s. Of the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, I try.
Oh, yeah, today. Okay.
I try mm-hmm. to really bring it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but then it, you have to have an understanding of what is today. So the fashion, I try to make look the that the fashion looks like today's fashion. And, of course, the interior design. So there's always a mix of modern stuff together with mid-century stuff. Mm-hmm. And also the architecture is this kind of, have all these elements together that... compose some type of a contemporary aesthetics.
Mm-hmm, which is also interesting because it looks so 60s, but it's like that's the style today, no? Yeah. But that's maybe also because it takes longer circles of architecture to change. But it will be very interesting to look at these pictures in 10 years, in 20 years, because they also reproduce somehow the old master's approach of portrait. It looks a bit like as if they were commissioning... And
I call it some type of a contemporary aristocracy, you know, because when you look at a painting, it's not something that the normal person has access to, you know, to have his own portrait.
Would you painted. Do portraits?
You mean like...
Commissioned?
No, not for this, because, you know, it's very easy. You just use a face swap and then, you know, I can put any collector's face. But for me, that's not interesting.
That's not what
I'm interested, in a way that these aren't... non-existent
dream figures like on the projection somehow, which I find interesting that it seems AD and all this it seems also that it motivates people to wake up in the morning and do stuff, because this is what they aim for, so you know. And tell me, were you concerned about the aura? Because I found your work through Instagram, and there's this guy in a pink shirt who's sort of, I don't know, transporting very strong, I don't know, it's like an emotional connection where I think this is looks interesting, you know, and it's a little homoerotic too. I think these what we talked about was photography and aura, were you concerned that, because eventually you could think only because it's painted, not necessarily the aura transport, but I think that the image created plus the very well executed oil painting sort of amplifies the aura, but were you uncertain that would be the case when you received your first?
Oh yes, definitely. And not all translation are as successful. This is also a lot of trial and error to see which designs actually look better in paintings or which ones actually don't. So that's also, it takes a lot of trying to see what translates well and what's not.
Mm-hmm. So you have to be selective after the process. So there's also trial and error in the virtual production, but also in the physical production.
Yeah.
You have to dismiss.
I mean, there's a lot of also alterations that happened during the painting process. So even that is like a process. It's not like a press of a button.
There's a view. So the spectator is in front of the glass, and then you look through the imaginated or like painted glass. So as if you would be like in the garden looking into the Neutrahaus or so. Why you do that? You create an extra distance between the spectator and the character?
Well, the character becomes in a way almost like one of the objects once it's behind the glass.
You know? Yeah.
Because you don't really know the relation of the character within the settings. It could be a visitor, it could be the artist, it could be the house owner. It could be anything, but the moment you have like this very good looking character behind a glass surrounded by all these beautiful objects, it kind of all become aspirational.
So these characters in the loft, they remind me of sometimes it has this Edward Hopper feel, but again, maybe that's also projection. These characters look more healthy, more self-convinced, at least in their appearance.
Yeah, more Instagram.
Yeah.
But you're right, the opera was a big inspiration into this work because I do like this kind of loneliness of a person being in a certain architectural setting, even like the way the light comes through the windows and stuff like that. But sometimes I feel also that Instagram is, I look at some people's profiles and it's just pictures of themselves alone in these beautiful settings, you know, just like one after the other. And I find that also very of our time, let's mm-hmm. say.
But interesting is that by coincidence, we both were in the ramp up to the exhibition, we both were sort of struck by an image of an interior feed of a Francis Bacon in some dining room.
Yeah.
Which I think is so interesting that, I mean, fully coincidence,
yeah.
this image was so strong because it's interesting. I mean, Francis Bacon belongs to the museum, but this idea of like eating and living with the energy, because I think that's also what we try when we do like smaller editions or prints and stuff. The reason we do this is to bring a wider group of people into the position to live with artworks.
Yes.
Because I think that you can only understand the power of art by spending time with it. You know, of course you can go to the museum, look at it, but this yeah. energy which comes, I think many people noticed through during Corona, at least I noticed to appreciate more, even though I'm daily busy with it, when you have the privilege to live with it, what somehow energy transition there is.
Yeah, I was always fascinated about famous artworks in the context of a bedroom, a living room. So, of course, that was a big inspiration to create this. And sometimes I do take those images and I reverse engineer it to kind of recreate it again in a different setting. So that was definitely a big part of that.
So, and talking a little bit about more general AI and its developments and the use in art and also the risks which are repeated, how do you see, how will art be changed by AI? I know a lot of artists, they use AI as a sort of inspiration tool. So they use their own work and ask AI for suggestions what to do next and sometimes choose from that. Mm. But how do you see AI will change the art society we are in?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I call them post-artificial paintings, because I do think that from this point and on, we will see a certain change. At the end of the day, it is a tool. There's many ways of using it. An artist can put their own artwork into it and kind of explore their own language that they already have created within the AI. They can just create certain elements like backgrounds or... I mean, there is a lot of stuff that you can do in it. And of course, I'm sure there's going to be many more artists that will reflect on the technology itself, not just use it as a tool. But I do think that eventually it will change something in painting, because I cannot imagine such a powerful tool and artists will not find ways to do original work with it.
Yeah.
Or to, let's say, advance painting one step further.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking again about the early video artists. And are you concerned about copyright?
No, because first of all, I know what I'm making and it's completely original. I know how it's created. And also once it's painted, it's painted. It's an object. So the painting kind of solves that. I think the industry of the AI should worry about copyrights because, you know, at the moment they just came out with this technology. Nobody really looked at from where they're taking it toward who is getting paid for being used their images. And I'm sure that will probably happen in the next 2 years, that they really need to rethink their business model and how they work with other people's work.
Because, I mean, the pictures in your picture, they remind you of artists, but they're not actual reproductions. They're just sort of interpretations somehow, which you can't really, you have the idea it might be this, think here a little of Warhol, but it's not really clear. It could be also something else.
No? Yeah, they're not trying to imitate the style. Yeah. I mean, the AI is very good in imitating style.
But I'm not
trying to create a painting, I don't know, like Degas, Van Gogh, whatever.
I'm
actually really trying to create my own aesthetics within it, my own style. And by now, because I have literally thousands and thousands of AI images that I created, most of the references that I use as images are my own AI images. Mm-hmm. I hardly use images from the outside world. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, I will take a photo of some plant or I don't know what and then upload it.
So it gets more and more like a self-reference, derivative of its own derivative somehow.
Yeah. My own closed circle of my own AI creations.
Yeah. And in general to society, I mean, you're probably busy with all aspects of AI in different fields. How do you see this changing?
Yeah. Actually, I did a really funny test that I asked the AI to write an art review on my paintings. And I was really amazed how well it did that. Not only, I mean, I did put some reference of the text, some of it that we're using for the press release, but it understood it so well and it worked in such a coherent way that any person will understand it. It didn't sound like one of those art
blah blah.
And
I think again, depending on how well you prompted, right?
Yeah, or what the references that you put in it, or the style that you asked it for. But I was more interested, I mean, I understood that it understood the concept because I put it as reference, my text. But what I didn't realize is that it's actually analyzing the painting as if it's looking in it. Because when we think about the act of seeing, it's a physical act for us, right? You know, it's happened with our eyes, with our brain. But the AI was describing the artwork as if it was looking in it. And that's what I found really fascinating, you know, that it actually became an external entity looking at that image and describing what it sees, you know.
But I think that's art historical protocol, that you first understand what to see, describe what you see, and then start to, also an old master, that's why I stopped, I didn't even start studying art history, because in my first lesson, it was about, you know, decrypting old masters, and then to say, okay, there's a red this and that stands for that, and you know, like a decoding, going from the explanation of the image itself and then moving more into interpretation. But you did you also tell to make a critical review, that would be interesting, you know, like
you know, that's a good
maybe like Roberta's, you know, career ending.
No, I'm totally gonna do that, like ask it to write like a really really bad review and see what it comes up with.
Great, Amir, thank you so much. It remains exciting to see what comes next within this world. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.